But before we do that, let me just explain why we want to do this. What kind of ingredients do we need to build a holographic correspondence and calculate various objects, various quantities such as transport coefficients? So what we want to do is the following. We will have this duality between a certain gravitational string theoretic background, but we will work in the limit of gravitational background, classical gravity ground, and there will be some quantum field theory. We will be interested in our quantum field theory at finite temperature and density, or at finite temperature and non-zero chemical potential, or chemical potentials, because in principle there could be many. And moreover, what we want to understand about our quantum field theory is the behavior of this theory beyond thermal equilibrium. But before that, we need, of course, to describe a thermal equilibrium. And then there are some tools in quantum field theory which allow us to look beyond that. And the regime that we will discuss at length on this side will be the so-called near equilibrium regime. So because we'll have this holographic duality, it means that all these ingredients can be translated quantitatively to the gravitational side or string theoretic side of the correspondence. And this means that we will need some tools. That's why I'm talking extensively about these laws of black hole mechanics and other things. So we will have our objects, such as black holes or black brains, in equilibrium. And then we'll need to understand what happens if you perturb your gravitational background. So suppose you take a brick and throw it into a black hole and see what happens, right? So that's something that disturbs your system out of equilibrium, but not much. Because of course you can also ask what will happen far beyond equilibrium. And that would correspond to things like gravitational collapse, for example, or maybe a merger of black holes, of things which are completely violent. And this is not our immediate concern. We want small perturbations, right? So perturbations of our gravitational background and consequences, in particular. We'll talk about the so-called quasi-normal spectra that will be quantitatively related to the near equilibrium regime of our quantum field theories. Okay? So this is the program, if you want, the philosophy of what we are going to do. And so far, we are looking at this side, talking about black holes and the four laws of black hole mechanics. But so this is something that you would keep as a beacon, if you want, as a focus point of where we are and what we want to do. So the four laws. So last time we discussed these four laws. Of black hole mechanics. And we were comparing them to the usual laws of thermodynamics in hope to convince ourselves that it's not accidental that the laws of black hole mechanics, and the gravity laws basically, can be formulated in the language which resembles or perhaps even identical to the language of the usual thermodynamics. And now, knowing that we have a holographic correspondence, I remind you that this, all of that was 1973 or around 1973. And of course, now it's very different. We know, at least in the cases when we do have this correspondence, we know that there is a language, there is a duality, so this is change of variables in this partition function. And this is why these laws are identical, because we do have microscopic degrees of freedom living, for example, in this QFT description that actually are behind this equivalence of black hole mechanics laws and usual thermodynamics laws. But let's proceed with that, right? So, and again, so I remind you that there are obviously open questions, because this is more general in the sense that it applies also to asymptotically flat black holes, such as the usual Schwarzschild black hole in four dimensions. And there, the situation is such that we do have these dual pairs for limited class of gravitational backgrounds, right? So it's not arbitrary. There is a set of examples where this duality is more or less established, although it remains a conjecture, but fairly well supported by various evidence. So the four laws of black hole mechanics. So let's start. So I will write them in the following way. So let's say black hole law, zeroth law of black hole mechanics. The surface gravity we will talk about this in a moment. Kappa is constant over the event horizon. And below, I will write down the zeroth law of thermodynamics, which is a statement of thermal equilibrium. Can be formulated in the following way. So the temperature is constant throughout the system in thermal equilibrium. Right, so these are two, so this is a zeroth law. Now, before talking about black hole law number one, let me comment on this surface gravity thing, because that is something that usually, well, you need to know how to, you need to know what this thing is. So okay, let me formulate this as a remark. So surface gravity you can think of it, so in some maybe slightly colloquial terms, as the local proper acceleration times the gravitational redshift. And we will see in a moment how this actually emerges. Maybe slightly less colloquially, the surface gravity kappa of a static Killing horizon is the acceleration as measured at spatial infinity necessary to keep an object at the horizon. So if you have a killing vector let's call it k mu, there is an equation mu k nu kappa k nu from which in principle you can compute kappa. And so killing vector of course has to be normalized because otherwise it's arbitrary. So this is all this, if you haven't seen it before, it may sound a bit enigmatic. But what I would like to emphasize is that it's so these words basically, I mean, killing horizon and so on. So if you haven't seen this before, go and find out, right? I mean, that's part of your skill. You know, if you encounter some unfamiliar pieces that you should be able to teach yourself what this thing is. Now, in reality, what we are talking about, so surface gravity, right? So of course, in kind of usual situation here on Earth, right, the surface gravity is nothing but g. So this is acceleration of free fall. And there is a wonderful equation that allows you to determine determinant, right? So you write something like mg equal to gmm, right, over r squared, right? It's a wonderful equation. And you calculate g, right? So you can do it also on Mars and Moon and so on. Now suppose you want to do it on or around the horizon of a black hole, which is given by the Schwarzschild metric in four dimensions. How would you do that? So you have an observer. So observers, in principle, if nothing interferes with them, they would move along geodesics, right, in a certain space-time. And you can happily calculate the trajectories of this motion. You can write down an equation for geodesics. But you can also have some characters who do not move along geodesics. So for example, you know, maybe some obstacles such as a floor, right, or something else. So perhaps they have some engine or somebody holds them, right? So suppose there is some unfortunate character who is about to cross the horizon of a black hole, but there is a rope stretching from infinity, and that's the last chance, right? So this character is holding the rope, right, and is hovering over the horizon of a black hole, and that rope, namely the obstacle, right? So this is a force, if you want, right? So how do you write the Newtonian equation, right? So ma equal to external force, right? If external force is equal to zero, you have equation of geodesic. If not, then on the right-hand side, there is some force that doesn't allow you to move along the geodesic. So the surface gravity, right, so here, right, is the acceleration necessary to keep an object at the horizon, right? So we want to compute, so if I'm hovering just near the horizon, I need to exert a certain force, otherwise I would move along the geodesic and go through the horizon, right? So that force, so or acceleration, is a surface gravity, and a simple, so there is a simple calculation which I would like to give you as an exercise, just to just so that you familiarize yourself with the concept. So it's a small, like I will ask you to do it in d dimensions, but just to right, so if you have, so this is acceleration of a static observer who is fixed. So static in the sense, of course, in four dimensions, everything moves, right? Even if the observer is static, this person is moving along time direction, right? So it's never static in kind of absolute sense. But static means that coordinates such as r, if we're talking about the spherical coordinates, theta, let's talk about the four-dimensional Schwarzschild space-time for definiteness. So these are fixed. And then the four velocity is dx mu over d tau. And for a Schwarzschild, right, so example G Schwarzschild black hole or Schwarzschild metric of black hole event horizon in 4D, then from the metric you can compute 2gm over r to power minus 1/2. So this is effectively the redshift factor, but okay, so for velocity, you compute dt over d tau as usual. Now, then we want to compute the acceleration, right? Because that's our kappa. So what is the acceleration? So a mu, so the acceleration a mu, so you have to define it in the way which is, so let me write this right, which is invariant. And the covariant way to define acceleration, so this is the equation for the geodesic, effectively. So you can convince yourself by writing the covariant derivative explicitly, and then remembering what u lambda is dx lambda over d tau. You can look at this and you recover the usual geodesic equation. So this is nothing as our x double dot in Newtonian physics, but now written in curved space-time. Now, this is because our u has only one component, u naught. This is written as u naught, and then the covariant derivative is d over dx naught, acting on u mu, which is zero, of course, plus a Christoffel mu zero rho, acting on u rho. And you continue this calculation. Now, again, so u, the only non-trivial piece of u is u naught. So and this derivative is zero because nothing depends on time. So here is only r dependence. So your result, so the result is u naught squared, and the only Christoffel that remains is mu naught naught. And then you look at your Christoffels for a Schwarzschild metric. You discover that the only one with t lower indices naught naught, which is not equal to zero, has index mu equal to r. So only gamma r naught naught is not equal to zero. You can happily compute it, and the result of this is that only one component of acceleration, namely ar, is non-trivial, and it is equal to something very familiar, namely to this expression. But then you compute the magnitude of acceleration. The magnitude of acceleration is so this is the square root of a mu, right? So you write this with, so this is the square root of g r r, so you have to lower one index. Write this down very explicitly. And the result of this, so the magnitude of r, if you substitute these components, will be gm over r squared. But then there is this factor which is coming from the grr, 1 minus 2 gm over r, which is a disaster in a sense. Because at the horizon, naturally, this diverges. So this is gm over r squared. And then I will write this factor as d tau over dt, right? So just to emphasize that this is the redshift. Okay. So naturally, yeah, so you can do this calculation, right? And you see that, yeah, there is a, if r is equal to r naught, then unfortunately, this acceleration is infinite. But it can be written as something finite times this redshift factor. And kappa, this surface gravity thing, is the magnitude of acceleration times d tau over dt, is defined this way. And this is finite and is equal to something that is not dramatically different from this calculation that people do in school. All right. Now, at the event horizon, so kappa at r equal to r naught, so I remind you that r naught was 2gm. Right, and c is equal to 1 here. Remind you again. So this is nothing but 1 over 4 gm if you substitute 2 gm here. And that's the surface gravity for the Schwarzschild black hole. But our yesterday's calculations revealed that the Hawking temperature is related to mass in a particular way. And I can rewrite this now as 2 pi times the Hawking temperature. The Hawking temperature was 1 over 8 pi gm. Right, for Schwarzschild black hole. So this is the calculation, right, which as an exercise I will ask you to repeat also for d-dimensional black hole metric that we had last time. But the idea is that also another exercise is look at this equation, which is more highbrow sort of approach. And again, so I we will not discuss this in detail, but if in your I don't know how you know how extensive your background in GR is, but if it is not extensive enough to have dealt with these matters, so go out and find out how to define this, compute this, and so on. Right. So just it's an illustration of what we need. For our purposes, it's important to understand that when we talk about surface gravity on that side, we are talking about temperature. All right? So this statement, and that brings these two statements closer together, right? Because so this statement about the surface gravity is a purely it's a pure GR statement, right? There's no notion of temperature and so on. But because of the Hawking radiation, we can also say that, in fact, talking about surface gravity, which is a constant over the event horizon, we are talking about the temperature. Okay, so this is a resemblance between the two things. All right, then there is also a first law of thermodynamics. And the first law tells us that there is a certain relationship between the change in energy, so the energy, well, it's conservation of energy, effectively. Right. So on the black hole side, you have the change of mass of the black hole is related through these objects, like the surface gravity, to the change of the area of the horizon, A. And more generically, if you have a rotating black hole such as Kerr, then there are other terms. And if you have a charged one, then there are other terms as well resembling the chemical potential. We have a change of a charge of a black hole, a change of angular momentum, and change of horizon area. Now, this, of course, resembles the thermodynamic law, first law of thermodynamics, which simply tells us that dE, right, the change of energy, is T ds, so this is this term here, plus various work terms, which I won't write explicitly. And they depend on, so this is similar to what appears here, so various things like involving chemical potential, PdV, and so on, right? So that's what appears here. OK, so now there is the most enigmatic one, the second law. And the second law tells us that in black hole mechanics, that the change of the horizon area is such that it never decreases. classically at least. So the area of the event horizon never decreases, classical. And of course, the second law of thermodynamics can be formulated in terms of the entropy, that the change of entropy is greater or equal to zero in any process. Now, finally, there is a third law, and that is more tricky. So let me formulate it like this. It is impossible by any process, by any procedure, to reduce the surface gravity kappa to zero in a finite number of steps. Right? And we have also a third law, which says that it is impossible to achieve the absolute zero by a physical process. Finite number of steps, if you want. So this is the analogy so far. Yeah, so I'm omitting. Yeah, please.
So for the second law, is it independent of the first law in the case of black holes? Because in thermodynamics, the fact that the entropy always increases in any physical process is independent of the first law, right?
The
fact that the entropy always increases.
Yeah.
It's independent of the first law of thermodynamics.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so because energy is conserved, but it doesn't guarantee that. I mean,
in the case of black holes, is this also the case?
Yeah, it is also the case, yes. So you need an additional, yeah.
Can you explain why? Because the way that I've seen it is that usually people say that if you increase the mass of the black hole, it increases the area. That's the usual argument. But relying on the first law.
Yes, but you can have you can have processes in which so the law itself, right? So it's this is not this statement is itself is a reversible statement in a sense, but it doesn't the law itself doesn't tell you in what direction you will go. It says that if you decrease what will happen, right? If you decrease the mass, the area decreases, and vice versa, right? So the law itself, in a sense, as the law of thermodynamics, it doesn't tell you in what direction the process will go, right? So in that sense, it is not. So it doesn't imply this. That's what I want to say. It doesn't imply this.
So then if I take out my black hole from equilibrium,
mm-hmm.
right? Then what I would expect is that its area would increase.
So if you take it out of equilibrium, that means that you either insert some energy or mass in it, right? I mean, taking out of equilibrium usually would involve some fields or maybe some matter going into the black hole and perturbing it, right? So then, what I would like to emphasize is that these are laws of thermodynamics, right? when you describe non-equilibrium processes, all these quantities, such as the entropy, for example, they do not apply unless you make a suitable generalization, right? So the entropy, temperature, and other quantities, these are characteristics of the thermal equilibrium, right? So when you perturb the black hole and it settles in a new state, then it is guaranteed by that the area will be larger and so on, right? So it will go in that direction. But what will happen in between? Just like in the think of the H theorem by Boltzmann, for example, right, or some fun concepts. It's very similar, right? So you can have the complicated dynamics of your gas coming out of equilibrium and settling in equilibrium, and you have the distribution function behaving very very different ways. So one of the problems that we will face is how to generalize. So I said that in thermal equilibrium or in gravitational equilibrium, you associate the entropy, the area of the black hole with the entropy. And yes, you want to count the microstates and so on and so forth. But that does not tell you what will happen if I, for example, start forming a black hole in the gravitational collapse, or I will have various black holes kind of merging around and kind of some violent process. All I can say is that in the end, then things are settled and nothing is time dependent anymore. Then this must be true. That's what this contest of the theorem. It is a non-trivial problem how to generalize these quantities to out of equilibrium processes, right? So that's exactly one of the difficulties. Right. Okay. So several remarks. Shall we do this? Yeah, probably. Yes. So another remark is that, of course, in string theory and in other generalizations of gravity, we'll encounter a more general combination of fields. So for theories, more general than Einstein-Hilbert gravity, for example, with the action, which can be written as some with the help of some Lagrangian, which in principle will depend on the metric, but it may depend also on higher derivative terms, such as some combination of Riemann, and then maybe derivatives of Riemann, and maybe some scalar fields or Maxwell fields, and maybe derivatives of these fields, and you can think of the rather complicated zoo of all these fields, and we will encounter them probably later today in the context of type 2B string theory. So in that case, the entropy. So we have this simple formula that tells us, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula that tells us that the entropy is one quarter of the horizon area. But in more general case, when you have these Lagrangians of that type, the entropy formula is generalized. And this generalization was considered by number of people, but usually is associated with the name of Bob Wald. And we will probably not, so let me write this formula and perhaps comment a little bit, but so of course, if you have only Einstein-Hilbert action, this equation will reduce to one quarter of the horizon area in Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. But I just want to warn you that things are more complicated once you start considering high derivative terms and more complicated Lagrangians. So for people who are interested in how to derive this expression and more importantly, how to use it in practice, because we will in this course, I hope we will do this calculation or at least outline the calculation of how to compute corrections to shear viscosity in n equals 4 supranormals using the higher derivative terms in the Lagrangian. And there are ways of, so in that case, in principle, our entropy, so the entropy could be in that case computed in two different ways. But one of them would be just to use the Wald formula, and people who want to actually explore this subject, I encourage you to maybe you can talk to me and you can do this little exercise for type 2B low energy string theory and with high derivative pieces and compute this thing and compare with the computations that we'll be doing on the board maybe 10 days from now or something like that. Okay? Yep.
What's capital sigma?
So this is the surface that encapsulates our, you probably know that, for example, how do you compute things like the mass of black hole or anything in gravity, right? So locally, the energy is not localized in gravity, right? So you have to define things like ADM mass and so on, right? So you have this huge sphere. So this is a generalization of the Gauss theorem, if you want, right? So you have this huge surface that encapsulates your gravitational system, and then you integrate all the fluxes of your gravitational fields and other fields here as well, which passes through this surface in some generalized senses, etc.
I guess I understand the capital sigma and the integral sign, but why does it have four indices in the D capital sigma?
Because this is not just the area. It is so this is a four dimensional object which contains
it's specific in four dimensions.
It's a four index object which contains also the normals ends in it. Right. So it's some expression which is not just the directed area. It has some indices which come from the normals and A attached to it. But look up more specifically what these things actually mean. You need to compute it. If you want to get some experience of what this means, I mean, without just imagine that your L is the Einstein-Hilbert term, and do this computation. It's an exercise, right? So find out what this sigma exactly is. Right. So. This reduces to the usual expression for black hole Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in case of our Lagrangian being simply equal to R, right? So Einstein-Hilbert term. Then, so the lesson that we draw, yeah. So one other thing that we will not discuss in detail is the Hawking radiation. So I just mentioned the Hawking temperature, but of course, you may ask me why I'm operating this. With this notion at all, what is this temperature? And, yep.
This wall of entropy, this, it seems like it's somehow aligned to terms like phi squared, phi double. It doesn't distinguish between the two.
Phi, what phi?
So if I have terms in my Lagrangian that go like phi to the fourth or phi to the sixth or something like that,
yeah.
This doesn't seem to see those things.
Yeah, but it is also these phi terms, they all are gravitationally coupled, right? So there is square root of minus g and the covariant derivatives of your phis that always couple gravity to your fields. So you cannot completely, you cannot say that my fields are blind. So this formula is blind to the presence of matter fields, because matter fields they're coupled with gravity. They influence them, right? So it's and so they don't exist in your Lagrangian separately from gravity, right? That's what I'm saying, right? So it's how precisely this works, you can do some exercises and try to compute it for your favorite theory, for example, I don't know, some Gauss-Bonnet or something like that, coupled with scalars. See that.
Is there an intuitive way of understanding this formula? As a way, should I expect that if I take a variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the Riemann tensor, that would give me a notion of entropy?
I don't know. Perhaps there might be some intuitive way of understanding this. In fact, otherwise it would never be written, right? This formula. I don't think I can answer this question. What you can do is you can read the original paper by Wald, which is quite transparent. I don't remember details of it now, but it is in this list of references. And it is a paper which probably gives you also some intuitive understanding of why you have this variation with respect to Riemann. Right, so again, the appearance of the Hawking radiation and this Hawking temperature is also a non-trivial ingredient in this discussion. So there are several ways of deriving, in quotes, Hawking effect or Hawking radiation. And again, I will refer you to one of the reviews. So for example, there is one by Karlip in 2008. I think it is in your reference list, who summarizes different ways of doing that. Is something that you can explore. It's a long story, but we will not go into that. So the lesson, the only lesson that I would like to emphasize is that it appears that black holes behave as thermodynamic objects with the following identification. Let me again restore all the appropriate fundamental constants. So the Hawking temperature and the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy are proportional to these quantities, the surface gravity and the area, horizon area of black holes. Modulo these remarks, but again, you're welcome to explore. Now, of course, what we need to understand is the microscopic theory. And that will involve quantum gravity, but possibly not only. So this is supposed to account for the black hole thermodynamics, as we discussed yesterday. It was a partial success in that direction. In counting the microstates and counting the black hole states, and it has been achieved in string theory, notably that paper by Strominger and Waffa, 1996. And I think it is also in your reference list, but you can see a review by Ashok Sen, who contributed very significantly to, continues to contribute to this subject. It's a huge subject, so people develop sophisticated techniques of how to do that. But it is not only string theory and other approaches. Quantum gravity, and again, there is a review by Karlip in 2009, which is in your reference list, that you can consult what people are trying to do to account for, to count microstates. And so the difficulty, of course, in counting, and that paper by Strominger and Waffa sort of philosophically underlies this difficulty, is that when you have a black hole, it is an object which involves strong gravity, so you do have a true singularity. So you need somehow to understand how what is happening with this object on the level of strong gravity, and you have no idea how to do that. The only hope is that if you build a model, if you build a description of a black hole that becomes a black hole with a metric and all these associated things, in some limit of a parameters, like charges and or some other parameters, and then become something else in the other limit of these parameters, where you can actually know how to count microstates. So this is a normal theory, like gauge theory or something where you know how to what the quantum microstates are. And if, moreover, this transition from this weak value of parameters to strong value of parameters where you have a black hole is guaranteed to protect the number of microstates, that is a very non-trivial statement, but there are models, and that's why they're so exotic. Like this is construction by Strominger and Waffa, which is fairly exotic from kind of the mundane point of view of the Schwarzschild black hole in asymptotically class space. So this is a construction which is made out of brains, and this is where you can tune your parameter from weak to strong, and you know that the number of microstates is conserved along the way. So you go to weak coupling, you know your quantum states, you count them just like you do it in quantum statistical physics. You take a log of this number of these microstates. This is supposed to give you the entropy. You calculate this entropy, and then you compare with the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of your gravitational solution, which you obtain from the same construction in the limit of strong coupling or strong values of these parameters. And you happily discover that the two results agree, give the same result, right? So that's what was achieved. But of course, what you really want to achieve is to take the Schwarzschild solution, right, and explain how to count microstates, but presumably would give rise to these thermodynamic properties of your usual asymptotically classed Schwarzschild solution. There has been progress, as I remarked. I mean, it's quite impressive and so on. You can read all these reviews, and I'm sure that there are even more modern ones that I'm not aware of. But as far as I understand this simplest and important question of how to account for the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the Schwarzschild black hole in class space is not yet answered, right? Because of the difficulty that I outlined, right? You don't have access. So if you knew how to describe your particular black hole in the language that would allow counting of these states, just like you do in quantum mechanics, you would solve this problem. But that has not been achieved so far. Right, now, two more remarks. If you take into account Hawking radiation, so remark. So Hawking radiation reduces the mass of black hole, they evaporate, and therefore the area decreases. So the generalized second law simply takes into account the total entropy, which is the black hole entropy, Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, plus the entropy of the environment. And then the statement is that this generalized entropy never decreases. Now, as I already said, if you have non-stationary processes, so for non-stationary processes involving gravity, identification of S with the area entropy with some sort of area. It could be area of not necessarily event horizon, but there are different other objects that you can try to You can try to cook up this identification. So it's less certain. On the other hand, so you may say, oh, this is a disaster. But on the other hand, remember that S is a thermodynamic quantity. Which may not be well defined far from equilibrium. Right, so this is an open problem. Because, as you might know, in the modern discussion of holography and ADS-CFT correspondence, it's precisely the far from equilibrium processes which are of interest. You can go to today's talk at 1 p.m. and find out. So people want to discuss things like turbulence, some emergent processes in the non-equilibrium systems, the dissipative structures, and so on and so forth. And it would be nice to have a language that would generalize this equilibrium quantities, particular entropy. But if you look in statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, let's say textbooks or monographs and so on for out of equilibrium for systems which are not in equilibrium, you discover that it's not so easy. So it's not clear. For near equilibrium processes, things are more or less clear. But when you go out of equilibrium far away, then this notion may not be well defined, although there are some attempts to do that. So the last remark is, that there are more exotic views on quantum nature of black holes, and you should be aware that they exist. So, and I mean sufficiently serious views. Exotic doesn't mean crackpotish views. I mean it's kind of so. One of them is the so-called fuzzball picture. Due to Matur, been developed for a long time, and I can give you some references if you are interested. This is just for your information. Then there is something which is called the quantum hair. Mostly of Gia and collaborators. That does not. Well, Gia has more hair than me, so that. that is not meant directly, right? So. So there is also something which is known as Kerr CFT correspondence, and that offers another exotic view on quantum nature of black holes. And you can consult papers of Trominger and John Simon. Again, I will give you some references if you are interested in that. So talk to me. All right, so we have happily ended this story of sort of little pieces which we'll need, not all of them, right? We'll need some pieces, so that we definitely will need some pieces for building up the holographic correspondence. And next time, we will start constructing the ADS-CFT duality. We will need some ingredients from string theory. You had a course in string theory, so I will rely on your fundamental knowledge of the subject. But nonetheless, I will introduce some basic ingredients again. In particular, our interest will be focused on the low energy limit of string theory because, as you know, this is a gauge string duality, but very little is known about quantum strings on rather sophisticated backgrounds. So we will quickly go into the limit where string theory is approximated by its low energy limit, namely the supergravity, or if you want the classical gravity and coupled to other fields. And this is the limit where we actually be able to do the concrete calculations. And our ultimate goal is to do the actual concrete calculations of, for example, viscosity, diffusion coefficients, and sound, and other things from the dual gravity. But we'll start doing this tomorrow.